Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, an hour-long conversation with Bill Binney, formerly the top technical officer at the National Security Agency, now a sharp critic of the surveillance state in the U.S. of A. And yes, he's going to talk about Trump-Russia and those phone calls reported by the New York Times, you know, Mike Flynn of the Russians and others. He says they didn't come from NSA surveillance of Russians. They came from the dragnet surveillance of every American. And so the idea that the U.S. persons had to be unmasked, he says, that's a bunch of BS. It's a wide-ranging conversation. We talk about Binney's former boss, Mike Hayden, who's on a national charm tour and is generally being treated like an elder statesman, when he's a big part of the problem. And he publicly lies about the idea of Obama not being able to order wiretaps on Trump because it was Mike Hayden who took the order from George W. Bush to wiretap Americans without any authority from Congress or the courts. There's a lot ahead, and I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions, making it all possible. People like Jason Ferguson, Janet Price, Tim McKay, and Joey Perillo. I value your support, and I invite others to join in. All the details are at peterbcollins.com. The Trump-Russia controversy continues to swirl inside the Beltway, and I remain skeptical about the central allegation that Russia hacked the Democratic National Committee, gave what they got to WikiLeaks, and used it to manipulate the election in favor of Donald Trump. Bill Binney, former NSA technical director, returns to the Peter B. Collins Show today. Bill Binney served in military intelligence, then joined the NSA around 1970, and he rose to be one of the top technical officers at the National Security Agency, and he resigned in protest in 2001. Bill, thanks for joining me again today. I always learn a lot when I talk to you.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Peter.
So, Bill, I want to talk about Trump and Russia and all of the stuff that is swirling, as I referred to. But I want to begin with an interesting piece that I picked up last week. It was a Reuters article that was nominally about Vault 7, the latest release of CIA hacking tools and related materials by WikiLeaks. And buried in the article is a statement that 90% of the U.S. intelligence budget aimed at surveillance is spent not on protecting Americans in a defensive manner, but on offensive attacks, offensive cyber warfare. And this is attributed to the departing NSA Deputy Director Rick Ledgett, quote, confirmed in an interview that 90% of government cyber spending was on offensive efforts and agreed that it's lopsided. Now, this is fascinating to me because in all of these discussions about America as a victim of Russian hacking, we hear a few references from lefties about how over the years the U.S. Manipulated elections or even, controlled them in foreign nations. But we have very little self-awareness about the very active and aggressive cyber activities that the U.S. is engaged in. Are you surprised by this 90% figure?
Actually, I'm not. You know, the Vault 7 included, from the reporting I saw, it said that there were over 700 million lines of code, of source code, which encompassed all the different types of attacks they had, taking advantage of zero-day problems in software that was developed, and also taking advantage of built-in weaknesses and knowledge of switches and servers and networks, and also operating systems and all the weaknesses in those, everything in the network, basically. And they kept those things very well separated from the defensive side, because they didn't want the defensive side to know that these weaknesses existed, because they're liable to fix them, and if they fix them, the windows would close, they couldn't see. So you see, that was what the NSA basically was the primary leader in this kind of activity. And by the way, I think in NSA the estimate was they paid on the order of $25 a line of code. So if you multiply 700 plus million times 25, that's how much it would cost to develop that code. Mm. That's why I say most of it was came from NSA, because CIA couldn't develop that, you know, in a couple of decades. That's long-term development by not just NSA, but also the Five Eyes, the other Five Eyes countries, and perhaps some of the other countries that are participating with them in this bulk acquisition of the Internet. So I think that they gave CIA a start, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we really don't have much awareness of the offensive cyber operations of the U.S. We know there's a relatively recent cyber command that is run by Mike Rogers, the same guy who runs the NSA. It is a wing of the Pentagon, as technically the NSA is as well. But we know about Stuxnet. We know just about a few of the secret cyber operations that have surfaced into public view. And I'm not asking you for any classified divulgences here, Bill. But this means that there's a whole lot that the United States is doing to provoke counter cyber attacks from various enemies, and most of us are completely uninformed about it.
I would say that that's probably true for the most part, and I think a lot of that activity they need to have. We need to have some kind of international agreement as to what is permissible and what isn't, or some kind of agreement among many multiple countries involved to either stop it, or because the Chinese hack us all the time, and so do the Russians, and so do the Israelis, and any number of other countries. So it's more of a question of having some kind of if we stop doing it, then you'll have to stop doing it. If we all agree to do that, stop, then let's proceed on that basis and agree to that. So
a Geneva Conventions for the web?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, sure.
Now, the Reuters story that I reference is nominally about Cisco, the network and router company based here in Silicon Valley. And after Vault 7's release, they put people on around-the-clock duty, and they fixed vulnerabilities in more than 300 different products. And the bottom line here is that Cisco is an American company, and to my knowledge, they don't evade taxes the way Apple and Google and a few others do. And why is it that our government wouldn't notify them about their zero-day vulnerabilities? Because many of these routers and other products have been on the market for years, and Cisco only discovered this after WikiLeaks published Vault 7.
Yeah, that's part of the problem I've had with the short-sighted thinking of the intelligence community in leaving all of these weaknesses out there and not fixing them just because they could penetrate those systems using those with those weaknesses and view whoever was using them, whatever they were doing. They could read and see what they were intending to do and what they were planning. And that's what they wanted, and so they didn't want anything fixed. Otherwise, if they fixed it, they told somebody and they fixed it, like Cisco's doing now, that means that window is going to close, and now they can't see in. And so that was that's the operational or offensive side of NSA, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The one that wants to break the codes to read what the potential opposition is doing. The defensive side of NSA is called the IAD, the Information Assurance Directorate, and that's about 20% of the population of NSA, and it's supposed to protect systems. Well, they can't very well protect them if they don't know all the weaknesses, you know. So if the offensive side doesn't tell them, they can't fix them.
Mm-hmm.
So that means they left us all vulnerable, and then, you know, that meant that we all got hacked because NSA is not doesn't have a monopoly on smart people. I mean, these weaknesses are going to be known by many people, at least some of them anyway. And so that means that we're going to get hacked into and broken into, and all our data is going to be taken. And that's what's been going on. And see, so I call it very short-sighted thinking. I mean, you know, you could figure things out without having to break into somebody and see what they're saying or doing.
And again, you have informed me over the years that NSA allows these vulnerabilities because it enables them to snoop more easily. But,
yep.
You know, I'm one of the half billion Yahoo users who's been hacked. I have friends who were exposed through the personnel office of the government. I know some people who worked at Sony when they were hacked. And, you know, we believe that our government is working to protect us and defend us from these types of attacks. But actually, they sit back and twiddle their thumbs and say, huh, isn't that too bad? Yahoo got hacked again.
Yeah. And then, of course, when those hacks occur, they say we need more money for cybersecurity. You know, that just is a swindle. That's all.
And you've identified a series of swindles here.
Yes.
The first is that we were told that we had to give up our privacy in order to maintain security.
That's right, and that's been a lie from the very beginning. I mean, they went at it in a professional, disciplined, targeted way. They could have stopped people from doing terrorist attacks, and they haven't done that. That's why. And so as a consequence is that people are getting killed everywhere because they can't see the threats coming. And because they collect too much data and dump it on their analysts, they can't get through it fast enough to see and perceive the threat. And so they can't stop it. And so the attacks occur, people die, and they go clean up the mess afterward and then look into the data about they've gone, oh, yeah, we knew all these guys. We knew who they were. They were bad guys, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, and I don't want to take you too far afield into my wacky politics, Bill, but I find problems with many of these so-called domestic terrorism events, including the high-profile ones like San Bernardino. The Orlando shooter was a Muslim with sexual identity problems. He also had been hazed by deputy sheriffs at the Port St. Lucie courthouse, where he was a paid outside security guard. And he made up stories about his connections to Al-Qaeda to try to get the rednecks to leave him alone. And then this is turned and twisted and you know, he's made into an operative of foreign jihadists. And, you know, it's not like I am in any way rationalizing that this guy killed 40-plus people at a nightclub in Orlando. But the way the story is framed, and then it becomes just part of the wallpaper where, oh, yeah, you know, we just say Boston, San Bernardino, Orlando, and everybody knows what that means. But when you drill down into each of those stories, there are serious problems with the narratives, and in most cases, the feds had contact with the perpetrators, you know, previous to the main event. So it becomes a problem here where we can't really trust much of anything that the government is telling us or what they tell us as part of this effort to keep us safe.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, just take the Orlando case. The fellow basically said that he was intending to hurt people. So that was intentions defined right up front by the perpetrator. And then later on, he bought an AR-15, and that became capability. So, you know, that means intentions and capabilities. That should have surfaced that person right to the top of the list to be monitored every minute of the day. And it didn't.
And we see that play out. There's a great journalist named Trevor Aronson who published a book reviewing more than 500 domestic terrorism cases, and only 1% were free of some taint, you know, like a paid FBI informant, a provocateur who sets up the crime, provides the means, and then, you know, they bust them just like that To Catch a Predator show that used to run on NBC, if you ever saw that.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
It's all staged for couch potatoes.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just all of these things, if they'd focused into a targeted view of data, instead of being going after this bulk acquisition on data and everybody, which gives them power over everybody. That's the reason they're doing it, really. And to do the common crime kind of investigation inside the United States and or target anybody they want, like the Tea Party or the Occupy group or Jim Rosen, the Associated Press, or anybody that's doing something that they don't like.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have the data and information to target them and try to find something that would, embarrass them or they could use for leverage against them and so on. That's the reason they're doing this bulk stuff. It's not, if they did a targeted, focused, disciplined approach, like policing operations used to do, you know,
mm-hmm.
it would be an effective way of doing business, and they could actually detect threats in advance and have a chance to stop them and save people's lives. But no, they're not doing that. They're going for the big spending money swindle, you know, so they can get more money out of the taxpayer, the poor schmucks, and the price of that. The reason that the only price that they have to pay is occasionally some of us have to die to keep it going.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but when I go to the airport to get on a plane, I experience what I call airport security theater. We know that when the red teams have attempted to penetrate airport security, they succeed over 70% of the time. Sometimes it's over 90%. And yet you see grandmothers who have to, disrobe and take off their shoes, and other people who might be a threat roll right through on pre-check. And I just find the whole thing to be pretty absurd, but an effective way of injecting fear into the traveling public.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's an operation that's done for show, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's how effective is it? I don't know. I mean, it probably has some level or some degree of effect, just because it's out there and things are happening. People are doing things. You know, you can see people with guns protecting people in the airport and so on. So it might have some effect. But the exact extent of that, I'm not sure.
I think that cockpit door locks have provided much more security for passenger airliners than any of the bullshit at the airport.
I think that's probably right. Yep.
Now, you've articulated a third swindle, which you said is in progress now.
Yeah, it has to do with the Russians and how they're trying to drum up a business of a second Cold War so we can be fleeced out of trillions of dollars. This is really the biggest swindle that they're really trying to get going.
Well, I want to come back to the Trump-Russia circus in a moment. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you about Mike Hayden. He was your boss at NSA, and he, I think, primarily is the reason that you resigned in protest. And he's got a new book out, and he's been on a national charm tour. And Bill Maher had him on his show and didn't mention anything about his history, just takes him at face value. I heard an interview on public radio here in San Francisco where he was permitted to play the part of the wise elder with all the spook experience. And no one mentions how much Mike Hayden lied, first as NSA director and then as CIA director. And Trevor Tim, who runs the Freedom of the Press Foundation and writes also for The Guardian, has a great takedown of Hayden that I'm going to link to in the show file for this podcast. It was published a couple of days ago at the Columbia Journalism Review. And he writes here that Hayden is everywhere, commenting on the day's news, inevitably being portrayed as Mr. Reasonable, a post-partisan straight shooter who will tell you how it really works. Is Mike Hayden a credible guy? Can we trust him in any way, shape, or form, Bill?
Well, let me tell you my experience with him. When I was working at NSA, basically he didn't, when it came time to doing a certain, like with the program, his comments about the thin thread program that we were doing was, it went basically like this. I've still got a copy of it too, a hard copy. It's a document that he published internally in NSA, sent it to all of the board. He basically said, when the corporation makes a decision and that then to go down a path, everyone should get behind it and do that plan. Follow that plan. In other words, it means don't be creative or innovative or think out of the box. Follow the plan. And somebody in the Russia shop gave me a copy of excerpts of a speech given by Ilyich Lenin in 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically said almost exactly the same thing, except it instead of corporation, it said the party. When the party makes a decision, you know, and all that, it follow the party decision. So, you know, there is only one way to go. And if that way doesn't work, which it didn't, by the way,
mm-hmm.
right? And that came out in 2005 and 6 after about $4 billion spent. And if that way they pick is the wrong way, that means you fail, which he did. And so therefore, if you have no creative or innovative thinking or any attempt at anything other than the corporate process, you more than likely will fail every time. And that's fundamentally what he fundamentally pushed at NSA.
Trevor Tim identifies a real whopper from Mike Hayden in the present context. He says, quote, "The President of the United States does not have the authority to authorize electronic surveillance. The authority was taken away from him in the 1970s with the great intelligence reforms of that era. The only institution of the U.S. government that can now authorize surveillance against a U.S. person is the United States court system." And Trevor Tim points out that it was Mike Hayden who took the call from George W. Bush and established the President's Surveillance Program without a FISA court order, I'm not aware of any documentation. Maybe there was a secret presidential finding and executive order. From what we know, Mike Hayden took the president's authority and ran with it and began to collect all of our telephone data, set up the switches like at AT&T in San Francisco that Mark, what was Mark's last name?
Mark Klein.
Yeah, Mark Klein exposed. So, this is just prima facie evidence that Michael Hayden is bullshitting us today.
Well, I mean, he's not a technical guy. He's a history major, okay? So, I mean, you know, he's looking at it from a history perspective, I think. So, not a technical way, so I have to forgive him for that.
Okay, well, you're more forgiving than I am. Next, I want to turn to an article that you co-authored with my friend Ray McGovern. And I've known Ray for over 15 years now. He, like you, served in our government. And like you, he was a Russia expert. He at the CIA, you at the NSA. And you co-authored this piece at Consortium News called "The Surveillance State Behind Russiagate." And let me quote. "What President Trump decides will largely determine the freedom of action he enjoys as president on many key security and other issues. His choice may decide whether there is a future for this constitutional republic. Either he can acquiesce to or fight against a deep state of intelligence officials who have a myriad of ways to spy on politicians and other citizens and thus amass derogatory material that can easily be transformed into blackmail." Explain the context here and why you believe that Obama did acquiesce to the blackmail of the black communities, the secret communities, and that Trump is basically, he has kind of rattled the cage of the deep state, and he's kind of on the cusp of what action he can take.
Yeah, Russ Tice was a whistleblower from NSA. He came out in 2003. He started talking about the problems he saw, and they basically tried to label him as mentally unstable, and you know they tried to ad hominem attack on the guy, so that they tried to discredit what he was saying. But fundamentally, he was involved in black programs and saw this particular program running. And what's coming out on President Trump is coming from this program. That is, it's a program that's been run in NSA in a very secret way in a sub-compartment of other compartments, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really backroom stuff kind of thing. where only a very few people are involved, and the targeting is against all the leadership of the U.S. government. That means the justices on the Supreme Court, the generals on the Joint Chiefs, the House and Senate representatives, the White House, the Department of Justice, and I assume that the director of FBI is part of that, and a lot of the federal judges, and a number of lawyers and so on. That is anybody who has any influence over anybody who has any power over the intelligence community. And so this has been ongoing for years. Okay.
And Bill, let me just amend, because Russ Tice did divulge that information to me a few years ago. And in addition to the people that you mentioned, he said that he personally saw the order to wiretap Dianne Feinstein, who was on the Senate Intelligence Committee and rose to become chair. He saw a wiretap order for an obscure senator from Illinois named Barack Obama.
Obama, that's right.
He saw wiretap orders for, and he told me, he said late at night he'd go rummage through the burn bags, and that's where he found.
That's how he found out,
these documents. He also said, confirming what you just said a moment ago, that judges like Sam Alito and John Roberts were wiretapped when they were appointed to their positions on the Supreme Court. So what Tice shows us is that the NSA has leapfrogged J. Edgar Hoover, who had, you know, paper card files of the dirt that he collected on elected officials, and he'd call them into his office and say, "Oh, Senator, you know, this is just between you and me, but your young blonde girlfriend sure is cute, and wouldn't it be a shame if this ended up in the Washington Post?" Yeah. So we have to presume that the same leverage is available to a Mike Hayden or his successors at NSA. We simply don't know the extent to which it's been used.
Well, we know some things. I think I'm fairly certain that they did it with Elliot Spitzer, because he was going after the bankers for defrauding people in the 2007-2008 financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the package deals that they were advertising as one thing when they weren't, that's a fraud, fraudulent solicitation.
Yeah.
So he was going after them, so they had to get rid of him to save their bankers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and part of the problem was that once he got into the banking people, he'd find out that they were forced to do it by the Dodd-Frank laws and by Dodd-Frank, and that would get back into Congress and people in Congress. So, you know, it wasn't just saving, you know, the bankers, but it was also saving their own Democrats.
And what about David Petraeus? That was a pretty artful outing of him.
And also General Allen.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they do it, I mean, even inside NSA, they had the program Love Intelligence, right, where that's what they called it anyway, where the analysts in NSA would look into the data to see if their lovers were cheating on them.
So let's recap this, Bill, and put it in declarative sentences. Do you believe that the allegations that Trump has made about being wiretapped have any basis in fact? Is he using the wrong language to describe a form of surveillance that he just, you know, isn't conversant with?
Yeah, well, I mean, really, wiretap is, obsolete. I mean, the term, it implies that somebody had to go somewhere and put a tap on a line. You don't have to go anywhere. All you have to do is get on the network, and you can go anywhere in the network in the world and order your switches or whatever switches are there or servers to do whatever you want them to do. So it's not a question of actually doing a wiretap anymore. It's really the ability to surveil everything. And then it becomes a question of targeting. Who do you want to target, to look at, to extract data and maybe embarrass them or leverage them or whatever you want to do?
And we saw this in Oliver Stone's film about Ed Snowden that you were a technical consultant for. And, you know, the actor just showed us in a scene that with the right security clearance, Snowden could call up almost any phone number or email address that he could find. And so we know that the capability is there. We know that they are collecting everything in these giant server farms, Bluffdale, Utah, the old Sony plant in San Antonio, Texas, and a massive infrastructure at Fort Meade. And so that's why so many people who say, well, look, I don't care if they're getting my metadata because I don't have anything to hide. What we really are subject to is that this data that's collected can be analyzed at any time in the future to be presented in a way that would compromise us, even if we felt, gosh, I didn't have anything to hide.
Well, you see, I have some fundamental problems with that statement. Like, if you're, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. I have three basic things I say about that. First, it's a good quote from Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, what you think is totally irrelevant. It doesn't matter a twit. I mean, the only thing that matters is what the government thinks of what you're doing. If they don't like it, they're going to come after you. And whether or not you think it's right or wrong is irrelevant. And the final thing is probably the most damning, and it gets to the attitude of people in this country, I think, more and around the world, a good many of them, not everybody, but certainly a good many of them. It says, a quote from Goethe that says, no one is more hopelessly enslaved than those who believe they are free.
Hmm. That's something to ponder. That's pretty powerful.
Yes, it is. And that basically describes the situation of a lot of people in this country.
So to the recent claims that started with a Twitter blast from Trump and, you know, the White House has tried to kind of expand the meaning of the terms that he used. But what's your bottom line? We believe from leaks to The Washington Post and The New York Times that there were intercepts of Trump campaign officials, both before the election and during the transition, in contact with alleged Russian security officials or people aligned with the FSB or the GRU. Yet we've seen no evidence of this. And if these assertions are true, Bill, how was this information acquired?
Well, the only way it would have been acquired from where I sit is from NSA's bulk surveillance of everything going on in this country. That would give them the ability to go through targeting, looking at specific people on the Trump campaign to see what they were doing, as well as looking at now President Trump, then candidate Trump. So I can see that that's probably the only way they could do that. Otherwise, you know. I just think CIA has an opportunity with some of the capabilities that NSA did to do a specific targeting. Again, going at it, they would not do the bulk acquisition of data, but they would do specific targeting, going after individuals with specific computers, IPs, and phone numbers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They could do that. But they wouldn't be able to. They don't have the resources to do all the bulk acquisition that NSA is doing.
So then this whole little mini drama that rolled out last week where House Intel Chair Devin Nunes Ubers to the White House is shown documents of intercepts that are described as incidental on the part of picking up the U.S. person, and I'll ask you to explain that in a second. But, you know, then he doesn't tell any other members of his committee, even Republicans. He holds one news conference, goes and briefs Trump on information that he got from the White House, which is a head scratcher, and then he goes public with a little more of that. And I see this as a giant diversion, attempting to divert the attention to leaks as opposed to an investigation of the bigger picture of these allegations of Russian interference in our election.
Well, also actually we needed to look at both for evidence of both whether or not the Russians did in fact try to influence the election. If so, how and what's the evidence of it? So far, we've gotten nothing on that. But when it comes to President Trump and his people in his campaign being wiretapped, I mean, we have at least some evidence of that with the conversations of the president with other presidents like Australia president and the president of Mexico.
Right.
Also, we have the conversation with Flynn's conversation, General Flynn, and of course, we see there's some other whistleblowers who came out from the military who were stationed at Fort Gordon, transcribers down there, Adrian Kinney and David Murphy Falk, who were testifying in public, and it's on the web, that they were doing translations of the U.S. People calling their families back home and doing cast iron translations of everything they were saying. This is like between husband and wife.
Right.
And they're Americans, and they have no warrant to do this, and that they were doing it all without warrants.
Those are reports that Jim Bamford gave us, right?
Yes, that's right. Jim published that in his book Shadow Factory, I think it was.
Uh-huh, I recall it, yeah. So as we look at this now, Susan Rice, the preceding national security advisor, is being hammered by the Trump supporters, claiming that she unmasked or asked for unmasking of the U.S. persons who were caught in these supposed incidental collection of foreign telephone calls.
Can we define incidental first here?
Yeah, please.
We didn't do that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Incidental. This is really what incidental is. It's the incidental collection of all the communications of every U.S. citizen in the country. Okay, that's really what it is. It's like the bulk acquisition of everybody's communications.
Mm-hmm.
The targeted stuff for terrorists and dope smugglers and criminals, that's the targeted stuff that they'll talk about. Everything else is incidental. And, oh, by the way, we can store it and we can mine it according to Executive Order 12333, Section 23C, without any oversight whatsoever. And that's exactly what's been happening, what's going on. Even the FBI's national security letters are issued under that order, under the authority of Executive Order 12333.
Mm-hmm. I thought the national security letters were authorized under the Patriot Act.
No, it's under Executive Order 12333. There's no oversight of them at all.
Yeah.
And it's all according to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in 2015 that national security letters are illegal and unconstitutional. Oh, that wasn't the Second Circuit. It was the federal court in Northern California and one in a federal court in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them. They ruled them unconstitutional. It was John Doe versus FBI, and actually it was Nicholas Merrill, Calix CEO, who worked with the ACLU as a lawsuit based against the FBI for.
Yeah, I've interviewed Nick Merrill.
Unconstitutional actions in the NSLs.
Mm-hmm.
And he won.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. And for some reason, he doesn't want to talk about it. I've tried to get him for a follow-up interview because we talked at the height of his conflict with the government. But since it's been resolved, he's keeping a low profile. But that was a very important case. I certainly agree. Bill, I also was a little tickled recently because I usually listen to 10 or 15 minutes of Sean Hannity's radio show on the way home. And you were a guest there recently, and I don't know if he had you on his Fox television show as well. Did he?
I was on there somewhere around that time, but I think it was the radio show came a week or two or something afterward.
I see.
I had been on there before, and then I came on his. I've been on his radio show several times too.
Mm-hmm. But it was real interesting to me because Sean, who's a very staunch Trump supporter, in my view, has never acknowledged the sweeping surveillance of American citizens by the NSA until his ox was gored, and I'm very happy that his audience now knows about the total collection and the dragnet surveillance programs. Tell me how it felt for you to explain this to his particular audience.
Well, I've always been trying to explain this to everybody because, and many times you can't, if you try to explain it one time, it doesn't get through. So you have to go back at it from several different perspectives before people begin to understand what the real importance of this the subject is and what's really going on. It's like if you read a textbook, you don't necessarily get it with the first read. You have to go back and read it several times before you understand it. It's the same with this, I think, in terms of getting to understand what this technology and the use of the technology and how it's really being used, as opposed to the words that people are using to describe it, like incidental collection, which is really we're collecting everything, but you know we'll call it incidental because it makes it sound a little more interesting, innocent, you know. And oh, by the way, we'll have a secret interpretation of Section 215 that allows us to take everything, and we'll have a secret interpretation of Section 23C of the Executive Order 12333 that allows us to collect everything on every U.S. citizen in the country. So it's basically we had a secret government subverting our Constitution, which I called treason against the founding principles of this nation. And they were doing it in secret. Why were they doing it in secret? Well, because they knew it was unconstitutional and illegal. You know, that's the reason they did it. And when it came out in the clear light of day and in a court of law, not an Article II court, but an Article III court, FISA is an Article II court, right? It's in the sixth floor of the Justice Department, and, you know, they only hear the government side. They don't have any argument to debate. There's no debate.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they just rule, yes, you've got the forms filled out, you dotted all the I's, crossed the T's, okay, here's your warrant, you know?
But what do you make of the report from, I'm trying to remember her name, she's a British former member of parliament, she works for the News Corp now, Louise Mensch, I think is her name, and she claims, that as she has reported more than once, that there were FISA orders about Trump, and that they were submitted last summer. The FISA court actually said no initially, and then when the order was narrowed, it was approved, according to Louise Mensch. Do you believe that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly possible. We should have a public viewing of the FISA orders, because I would say that court should be abandoned, abolished, and dispersed. And the judges on it should be basically ashamed of what they've done, because they've issued, I mean, just looking at the Verizon order, that's a general warrant for 110 million people. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution says you have to define who you're going after and why.
Yeah.
What's the probable cause? Well, there's 110 million names that are missing, and the probable cause for each of them isn't there. So it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. I mean, these people are judges. They should know that. I mean, they should be ashamed of what they've done.
Well, Bill, that's a very strong statement you made, and I support it 100%. The FISA court has no place in our culture and society, and all these layers of secrecy are becoming a huge burden and liability now. And in particular, as we endure this Trump-Russia controversy, where there's almost zero evidence that has introduced. And I just want to cite three recent articles. March 24th, Miami Herald, Glenn Garvin writes, with a headline, "Were the hackers who broke into the DNC's email really Russian?" And his opening sentence is, "Who says the hackers were Russian?" Then at Zero Hedge, Tyler Durden on the 26th of March, "The evidence that Russia hacked the DNC is collapsing." And then Michael Senato on March 23rd at Counterpunch, taking down CrowdStrike, the private security company hired by the DNC, the only operation that evaluated the servers that were reported to be hacked, and their immediate claim that Russia was responsible, which is the basic assertion on which other assertions and news reports have been based. But we have no evidence still that Russia or Russian operatives were responsible for hacking the DNC and that they then handed off that data to WikiLeaks. This is still purely an assertion, in my view. Have you found any evidence to support it?
No, I haven't. But in fact, I think the attack was really something originating out of the Ukraine. It was developed by software developers there. And then I think it's being used by any number of it. I think it's a well-known attack. And so you really don't know who has it and who's using it until you look at the entire log for the server of the DNC. And the problem is that nobody's letting the FBI into the server, right? They only let CrowdStrike in. They didn't let the FBI in because they might find something else there, you know? That's something they didn't want them to find. So I would say that... How many people hacked into the DNC? I would say we don't know that. How many people hacked into Hillary? We don't know. How many people hacked into Podesta? We don't know because, you know, who has looked through the network logs that cover those servers? Nobody that I know of. But if they do, they might find that, gee, the Secretary of State of the United States, a very high-profile person, was really a target of many countries in the world or many hackers or hacker groups. And the same is true for everybody else there. You know, people want to know what the, what's going on there, and they'll try to hack in. And it's true for individual hackers. It's true for hacker groups. They'll try all kinds of things. It's also true for many countries. So how many people did that? Well, as long as they don't let the FBI or NSA in to analyze the log, the network log of each of the servers, they'll never know. And that's that makes the construction of any narrative you want easier to do.
So when you talk about the Ukrainians, are you referring to the malware called Agent X?
I think that's one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was news to many people, but certainly not to you and me, Bill, in the wake of the Vault 7 release, that you can obscure an IP address. You can.
Yep.
There are VPNs that generate IP addresses, and you can design them. You can control them. And with the introduction of this concept of Agent X, which similarly obscures the actual location of the originator of this signal, this really just once again makes it clear that anyone who claims with any sense of certainty that they know that Russia was responsible for hacking the DNC, they're really bullshitting, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and that's one of the reasons why I said it. I mean, you could look into deep packet inspection and then find you can find truth down at that level, but at the transport level, you can play games, which is what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to see, NSA has trace route packets, trace route software all over the network, hundreds of things, all deployed at switches all around the world. And what the traceroute program does is it traces the path of packets, individual packets, through the network. So that means that even if you are, say, for example, at CIA and do an attack on the DNC and want to make it look like the Russians did it, the packets that come out will still trace route back to you at CIA, not to the Russians. So the NSA will know where those packets went.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where they go, and that's really the source of it, no matter what they try to look like.
And basically, this is classified information, but the president has the power at any moment to order information declassified. And not only could he lift any doubt about whether there was a FISA action or not, whether there was a hack or not, the president does have the ability to bring clarity to these fuzzy issues if he really wants to, doesn't he, Bill?
Yes, he does. He can. If people don't obey him, I mean, he can give them direct orders. Then, if they don't obey, they can be fired.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about a guy who surfaced for me just last week at the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's described as a former FBI agent and national security expert, Clint Watts. And here's a quote that he gave to Vice News just yesterday. He said, if you looked at Trump's Twitter feed this morning, he cited a WikiLeaks release, essentially, which was conducted by the Russians to attack Hillary Clinton yet again. Russia stole information. Trump is still using it against his opponent, and he already won the election. So he's giving Russia a victory even after the election, and they were already winning before. Now, given what we've discussed, Bill, here is another case of somebody providing these very strong commentaries based on what we believe to be bullshit. And so, you know, for him to blame WikiLeaks and say that they're essentially the Russians and that this is yet another attack on Hillary Clinton facilitated by Donald Trump, he has no basis to make these claims, does he?
No, he doesn't. I mean, that's the whole point. There's no factual evidence behind anything that's being said about the Russians. That's why they should have gotten into the network servers' logs, you know, because everything that you do in the network gets logged. If you send a code down from a certain area, IP that goes into the another IP or another server, that gets logged in the network log. Every time you click the mouse, it sends a line of code down the network, and it gets logged in the network log. So that then would tell you who's doing what on the network, where and where, what they're doing, and basically where they are.
And so we, you know, this was sworn testimony delivered to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I'm reading reports that Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat, lurches when he hears a sound outside his office and thinks, you know, that it's a Russian drone or something. Have these guys kind of spun themselves up into a fictional hysteria?
Well, I think, you know, it's like Chicken Little, the sky is falling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you got any number of Chicken Littles going around saying the sky is falling, that kind of united, you know, with that many voices saying the same thing is supposed to add validity to what they're saying. When in fact, that's a fundamental fallacy in terms of logic.
Mm-hmm.
You, without any substance behind it, just the fact that people are saying it doesn't make it true. That's the point.
Yeah. Bill, one of the things that surfaced recently, again, in this frenzy about Trump's tweets and desperately trying to prove that his assertions are true, people pointed the finger at Britain's equivalent of the NSA, GCHQ, and said, oh, well, it would have been easy for NSA to just ask GCHQ to manage the surveillance that is illegal under American law. And the British government, you know, flatly denied that with great emotion and flourish. But it's pretty common knowledge, isn't it, that the Five Eyes routinely swap surveillance that would be illegal under their own domestic laws?
Yeah, well, let me put it to you this way: with NSA doing all the collection, bulk collection on American citizens and putting it in databases, the dirty little secret is that GCHQ and the other Five Eyes by now have direct access into those databases using a program called IC Reach. It's on the web. You can see it. It was part of the material that was released from Edward Snowden. It shows the connections of the GCHQ into the NSA and the databases for NSA. And that's basically been that way for decades, ever since, you know, World War II, fundamentally.
Hmm.
So, the sharing has always been there, and they've had very close relationships and organizations. You know, they're very close anyway. They're closest allies that we've ever had. So, the only other people who have access to that kind of data are CIA and FBI and DEA, and in the DEA, by the way, there's representatives of the IRS that are there that also have access.
That's interesting.
Well, that's how they got into the Tea Party.
Now this triggers a question that I just thought of, Bill, and that is back in October. We had Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, go public with the weasel word statement that, you know, the hacking is consistent with what we've seen Russia do. Then in the final debate, Hillary, hits the multiplier and says 17 intelligence agencies have confirmed that Russia hacked the DNC. Now, many people think that's impressive, but I like to cite, for example, that one of those 17 agencies is the Coast Guard. And are they really telling us with a straight face that the Coast Guard evaluated information related to the claims of Russia hacking the DNC and raised their hands and said, yes, we have high confidence on the high seas?
As long as it's within the, you know, the 200-mile zone of the coast.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, I mean, when you don't have any evidence to back up your argument, you need to assemble as many people as you can to say it's right. Okay, that's fundamentally what's going on here. They're assembling any number of people up, you know, all these agencies are saying it, so, you know, as long as you get them all to line up and say it, you know, but it doesn't make it true again because there's no fundamental evidence to show it.
That's now, I know that Clapper was atop the organizational chart of these 17 agencies, but his agreement with these assertions doesn't mean, for example, that the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency has signed off on the consensus, right?
there's certain, most of them wouldn't have any way of knowing anyway.
Right.
So the only ones that would be NSA and CIA, fundamentally.
Yeah.
And FBI. That's it.
All right. Now, with that in mind, the January 6th release from the FBI, the NSA, and the CIA was mostly an attack on the Russian-backed American network, RT. But in the early part of the document, before the blank pages, there were, you know, these statements like, "We assess with high confidence." So no evidence was provided once again, but there was a minor departure by the NSA, which said that it only assessed this bullshit with medium confidence. So, Bill, translate that for us. What really occurred there, and why did the NSA take its assessment down a notch from the other two agencies?
Because they're just trying to follow in line with them, and they have no evidence of tracing the packets anywhere. That's why I said it was an inside job back in December in Consortium News. That was the inference I made from that. It was based solely on the fact that NSA should have known exactly where those packets went. And when they said that, that kind of statement says, we don't have any evidence of where the packets went. That means they didn't go anywhere. That means it wasn't a hack. It was an inside job, and somebody put it on a thumb drive or something, and handed that thumb drive to somebody and transferred it across to WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a hack job. Otherwise, NSA would know where the packets went.
Right.
And there wouldn't be any equivocation whatsoever, none at all. They should know exactly with certainty where things are. And that tells me they don't know.
And are they allergic to the term slam dunk these days?
No, but that's the kind of thing that they would, that's the new term, I guess, is high confidence.
Right. Now, I don't know if you've ever appeared on a show on the RT network, but I know,
yes, I have, yeah.
I know a few people who work there. I've met Abby Martin. The claims that the intelligence report of January 6th included about her were stale and false. Yes, she had hosted a show that challenged the credibility of America's electoral process, but it was 2 years before the 2016 elections, and she had left the network in the interim. Tom Hartman is a guy I've known for more than 15 years. He is a very solid and credible host. I've been there during the production of his show, and there wasn't a single person there who spoke Russian. And there was no red phone to Moscow. Ed Schultz is a recent recruit there, and I don't think Ed knows much about foreign policy, and he doesn't really attempt to cover it. He's a domestic guy who talks about worker issues and that sort of thing. And then Chris Hedges, the highly respected former New York Times Middle East Bureau chief, has a show on RT as well. And based on that, I simply find it laughable that the intelligence report asserted that, this is a devious Russian plot and that it actually is working. There is no evidence that anybody in the United States watches RT. I mean, the audience is so small that to imagine that they had any impact on the 2016 election, I think requires you to believe that Boris Badenov was 6 feet tall.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, you see, the point is, for example, that when the intelligence community didn't have anything to say, they had to find something to talk about. So they inserted RT in there as a propaganda organ. So that was the way they argued it. But I've been on both of the shows, Abby and the other fellow's show, and any number of other shows on RT, and I've never found them to be anything but attempting to do an objective job.
Well, Abby Martin criticized the Russian government over the issues related to Ukraine and Crimea, and she didn't get fired.
Yeah, yeah.
She left of her own volition, and yet they have spun this up, that she's just a pawn of Moscow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you have nothing else to do, you have to do an ad hominem attack, okay? Once the ad hominem attacks against the person attacks start, I mean, you know that they've lost their argument. They have no argument.
Yeah. So, Bill, I know you don't have any kind of crystal ball, and I won't make you an oracle here. But, I kind of cut my teeth as a radio host during Watergate. I owe my early rating success in Chicago to Nixon and the impeachment process. But I have a hard time predicting where this will go, because we are so far down the road, and as you and I have referenced repeatedly, there is no substantive evidence to support almost anything that has been asserted. We've got compromised investigations at both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees because both chairs have carried water for the Trump administration on this this set of controversies. And the idea that Jeff Sessions has recused himself, and this guy Rosenstiel, I think is his name, who is likely to be confirmed as a deputy attorney general, will have the independence to appoint a special counsel with a budget and sufficient freedom to actually pursue this wherever it goes. I see this as heading into cover-up territory and will likely never see it resolved.
There's one ray of hope here that I think is existing, and it's the fact that I think President Trump is being attacked by the intelligence community, and that has spawned him to say things like it needs to be reorganized and restructured, and that is a ray of hope that might actually do something that could be positive and help resolve some of these issues. And that certainly, if I have my way and I have any way of getting information in to help him do that, I will do that.
Well, I would certainly support it, and we do need a full top-to-bottom review. We need to revise a lot of policies. We need to expose a lot of things that are kept secret, including things that we know aren't secret.
That's right.
But I think that Trump stumbled into this battle with the deep state. I don't think he had any idea of the dimensions of it and what he's actually taken on here.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, he's not a member of the deep state. That's part of the problem. He's also not a politician. And the politicians on both sides really are looking at him as somebody as an outsider. And so here comes this outsider in, and if he starts doing things that make the country succeed on a grand scale, that's going to look all make all professional politicians look bad. And so I think that's part of the thing he's fighting also. He's also fighting that.
Well, so far, there are only two things that I really agree with Trump on. One is that you can't take out Assad and the Islamic State from Syria at the same time and create, you know, another failed state with opportunities for regional actors. And I also, in general, support his approach to Russia. Now, I do believe that Putin can and perhaps already has played Trump, but... You know, on a policy basis, I think that the hysteria and the effort to gin up a new Cold War is a serious mistake. And to see so-called progressives and Clinton supporters drawn into this and essentially eager for a confrontation with Russia, it truly is bizarre, Bill.
Yeah, because it denies any opportunity for actually moving forward in a positive way. I mean, you should at least go into it with a little hope that something positive can come out of any kind of dialogue, you know. And instead of shutting the door and, you know, like when Churchill said an iron curtain has fallen across Europe, you know. Well, I mean, we can put that iron curtain up both ways. It's not a one-way thing either. So, I mean, being able to have a dialogue at least gives the opportunity to actually progress and make some improvements. And if you shut that down, why, you lose that opportunity.
And do you think this was driven by a desire to prevent Trump from normalizing relations with Russia, so to speak, or was it an effort to cut him off at the balls?
I think it was, inside, you know, we had some people who have passed some information out to some of the VIPs, you know, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity.
Sure.
And they said, you know, back in the Pentagon, whenever the Russians went into the Ukraine, everybody was cheering because it meant a new Cold War. That meant more money, more for defense, more spending, more budgets, more bigger budgets, more contracts, you know. And so there's this whole group of what I call warmongers who want to keep everything going so that you can have this, like, perpetual feeding off the population of the United States to feed their warring mechanism, you know. And I just think that's the wrong way to do it. And I think Trump, I think he's probably, they look at him as a threat to that.
Mm-hmm. Yet the signals are mixed. You know, he's basically busted the sequester with a 10% proposed increase in the Pentagon budget. And there's no definition of why that is necessary. You know, he claims that the military's been hollowed out and all that stuff. But, hell, they've had increasing budgets every year. And except for the sequester, the Pentagon has been written a series of blank checks since 9/11.
Yeah, except for the F-35, which he canceled, which was a $350 billion project.
Right.
Almost a third of a trillion, a little more than a third of a trillion, on one airplane. You know, so he stopped that. And so I think he's got a business sense also that they don't like, because he's going to be looking at their programs to see how efficient and effective they are. They don't really like that. You know, return on investment is not something that basically government agencies have ever had to worry about. You know, in the intelligence area, you know, they're not even audited by the U.S. government. They don't audit their intelligence agencies. Like NSA doesn't get audited, or CIA. They don't get audited. How do you spend all these billions you're giving them? They don't care. They don't seem to care. They don't follow up on how it's the budget office doesn't go out there and say, you know, we need to review all the spending that you've done to make sure you're doing things the right way and, you know, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even do that. So.
Yeah. Well, Bill Binney, as we wrap up, is there anything that you want to mention that I haven't gotten around to?
No, I think that we pretty well covered everything. Yeah.
All right, Bill. Well, I really appreciate your honesty and the information that you share. And we will talk again in the future, because I know this isn't going to be resolved immediately.
No, it isn't, Peter.
Yep. All right. Bill Binney, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, too.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Bill Binney all the way to the end. Your comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.